Hey, Scott, $350 or less, a complete 7-day guided tour from Chamonix through the Alps. I say we go.
Holy cow, that's cheap, Freeman.
Well, it's a value, that's for sure.
Let me tell you a little bit more about this. Our new trail friend and the new producer of Trail Runner Nation podcast, Doug Mayer, he lives in Chamonix, France. He's from the United States, lives in Chamonix. He's the owner of runthealps.com. And this is a company that gives guided tours of some of the most spectacular mountains trails in the world. And he does tours of like Tour de Mont Blanc, the Eiger Trail, the Italian Dolomites, the Matterhorn. But in this time of COVID, they can't do those tours. And he has developed, I think, one of the most genius things I've heard in trail running. And that is a 7-day virtual tour of those trails around Chamonix.
You always can't get out there, Scott. There's things that get in our way, travel, but you need to experience this beautiful part of trail running, and you can do it with this tour.
Starting on July 4th, so you need to register now. July 4th is the kickoff Zoom meeting where you'll meet your group and your guides and some of these iconic trail runners that Doug has put together. And then every day for the next 7 days, they're going out on a trail run and introducing you to some of these great trails.
Hey, and prices to meet every budget, from $50 up to $350. And as I heard it, Scott, don't know if it's true, but for the big price, they'll send you a piece of the mountain and somebody will come by and skin your knee to make you feel like you've been there.
And here's the other kicker that you can't say no to. When you register for this virtual tour, you get a $100 gift card for a future real tour. So you can take the virtual tour this year, and then next year or the year after, if you decide, I actually want to go there now, you can take and have that $100 credit towards that tour.
Yeah, I love the idea. I love the fact that I get to actually run and see the Alps, learn about them, so that when I do run them, I know something about them. The second trip is always the best. So start with the virtual tour.
Find out more at runthealps.com. Make sure you register today because this race starts next week.
Yeah, thank you, Don. You know, I mean, I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, you sound like a nice guy on this podcast, but
I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
What are you balancing your checkbook over there, AJW? What's going on?
Yeah.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Ward.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And today we have Mike Ambrose. He is just a short little ways away from us in Annecy. Is the way he said it.
Scott, we rehearsed this.
We did rehearse this.
It can be pronounced many ways, but we know France is solid. But it's Annecy. You can say anything you want.
But it's in France.
It's in France.
Nearby Chamonix, is that correct?
Yeah, about 1 hour 15 from Chamonix.
And Michael is a product line manager for Salomon. And so we're going to dig into that. But the first thing we're going to talk about is about his love of trail running, because he was recommended to us because of his passion for the trail, and we all share in that.
Have we let the cat out of the bag about our producer Doug?
Well, I think this is the time, and I think Michael actually, because he's such good friends with Doug, I think you should describe Doug and what you know about him coming over to TRN. I would be interested to hear his side of the story.
Let me give some context. So we recently met Doug Mayer,
yes,
who's a frequent contributor with Trail Running Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out that he knows a little bit about audio production.
Well, for 25 years, he helped lead the number one show at NPR, the
Car Talk,
and he was behind it. And so somehow we were able to get in front of him, and he's with us now.
He decided he wanted to try to help us. He felt sorry for us. It's like being a runner out on the trail, and you're all dirty. You're laying on the ground. You have spittle coming out the side of your mouth, and another runner comes by and says, "Hey, can I help you? That's kind of what happened.
No, it was worse than that, Scott. It wasn't spittle. It was cramping, vomiting, and just flat out of gas.
So Doug has come on board, and we'll be talking to him a little bit more down the line and finding out what he can do to try to help this poor podcast. But he is good friends with Mike, and he said, you know, you should get Mike on. He has a really unique story, a really great story of how his life has changed and evolved around this great sport and culture that we love, trail running.
So what can you tell us about Doug that maybe we should know that Doug hasn't told us? Because we feel that Doug probably hasn't fully disclosed everything, and only people like you, Michael,
at
would
this
know.
Point, we think he has a halo around his head and he has wings, that he's this great guy. So we need some dirt.
Well, I'll first say that if you were to be on the side of the trail throwing up, he would be a great person to share that with, or, you know, at least have along for the journey. Definitely one of the most creative and nicest people in the sport. And I can't say enough good things. So I don't know if I can really help you with dirt. I guess I have to be maybe joining him for a Tour de Jean or something like that. To really see a dark side of him, because I don't have a dark side to share. Just a really positive, and like you said, I mean, with Car Talk and everything he's done in trail running tourism, it's just been super creative and well thought out. And I think that's a perfect description of him. So
good.
Truly lucky to have such a good friend and a fellow American over here in France.
So the only dirt you have on Doug is the literal dirt that he got picked up on the trail from the run this morning.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But I'm sure, you know, it's just the beginning of our friendship and partnership and some stuff with Run the Alps. So, maybe a check-in in 6 months would be,
and we're going to talk about that down the line too. Doug has started this great service to our community called Run the Alps. And we'll talk about that down in future episodes, because I'll tell you, it's pretty cool what he's done and with his team of people over there, including you.
And ironically, Mike, this is exactly what he said about you, the nicest guy on the trail. And so let's talk about the trail. What got you into the sport? As we all have an entrance story. What's your entrance story?
Yeah, it was actually, it's pretty funny. I was on Patagonia's website looking to get a new wetsuit. So I was surfing a lot at the time, and I was in college, my senior year, and I just kind of started to run on the road more seriously. Like, I think that day I actually went to a City Sports in Washington, D.C. and bought a pair of Mizuno Wave Riders or something, because I was going to try to run the Richmond Marathon or something. And I was on the website and I was like, I'm looking around and I see there's a sport, you know, next to surfing. It says trail running. I was like, no idea what that is.
And what year is this?
2010 or 2011.
Okay.
And yeah, I clicked on this link and I saw a video about Chrissy Mayle, and it was like, it blew my mind. I was like, whoa, people run, you know, 50K, 50 miles. And I was 100 miles. And it was just a video about her story. And it was called, I think, Tracing the Edge. And it was about, yeah, people were doing cool stuff. And there was also some stuff with Jerry Lopez, and there's other people, some climbers as well. I think the Malloy brothers for surfing, but there's just people doing really cool things and putting themselves out there. And I remember seeing it, and it was like, whoa, I was captivated. I didn't know what it was. I've never done it. And it was just something I knew I had to do the next day. So that's what I did. Went out and found a trail in Fredericksburg, Virginia. So yeah.
Well, so
the genesis of it, I guess.
The next day you laced up your shoes, and instead of going out and run on the road, you found a trail and ran on it. And that's how you got into the sport.
Yeah. It was this little quarry path. And I remember, like, I think I saw like a big black snake, and I was like, whoa, this is intense, you know? And then, yeah, I mean, it's just kind of evolved. And then, I mean, it's crazy now to be a part of a company like Solomon. And the first video that really got me jazzed, like, I had to drop everything in trail run, was a Solomon TV episode. And this is like 2012. And I was like, it was actually about the UTMB and running in Chamonix. And it's just pretty crazy now that I get to live that. And I've actually been spending the past month and a half in Chamonix with my wife. So it's surreal. It's totally surreal.
So I've got a question for you. You sitting here today, what would you tell Michael that got on the trail for the first time? What would you put into his ear? If you got to go on a trail run with that young Michael, what are some of the things that you would share with him?
Step over the snake.
every twig is a snake. No, I think it would just be to be patient, you know, let the trail come, be patient with it. I think at one point I definitely tried to rush things either in racing or training or career wise. I think just patience. And I'm learning that it's been one of the best virtues that it's been bestowed on me, is just be patient, like in everything in life, you know, with finishing school, with finishing anything you're working on and anything you dive into, just be patient. I would say that's, yeah, just be patient.
So I'm curious. So you went on this first little quarry trail run with this black snake. What happened from then? I mean, it sounds like the hook set deep. What did you like about it? What kept you going, and what pulled you deeper?
Yeah. So actually right after that, I went, shortly after that, I ran the JFK 50. I'm going to sound like an old man and dated here, but I mailed in my entry to JFK that year, which was not that long ago, but
no.
Crazy how fast things, but I mailed in an entry and I decided to run JFK 50, which isn't really a trail race. It's, just an ultra. So I did that. And then this whole time I'm discovering the sport, like learning about, you know, you stumble on Chrissy and Dean Karnazes and then ultimately Tony Kropitschka and Killian. And, I think I just kept learning and learning and going on new trails and experiencing new things. And I think it's a pretty similar story. But I knew when I was doing it, I felt different. It consumed me in a way, but it made me feel powerful. It made me feel good. It cleared it cleared my head. It was an identity too. Like I felt cool. Like I thought it was this really cool, unique thing. I didn't even know this world existed. I thought I was this kind of fringe guy, like running on trails. Like little did I know it could be someone's whole life, you know, in a lot of different ways. But I think it was just the pure joy that I experienced. I still feel that every day. Like, you know, I went today and ran on the trails here, and just the pure joy is just in the moment. It's the best feeling in the world. And that's what stuck with me.
How did you connect with people on a trail? I mean, I assume the first trail run you were alone.
Well, there was a snake.
Oh, there was a snake.
Yeah, and probably people living along the quarry too, but that's
another. Tell us a little bit about the people that you met early on, and what did they teach you?
Yeah, actually, so as I was in this discovery phase, I was trying to do everything. And I remember hearing about like a Ragnar Road relay. And I was like, well, this is crazy too. I don't know what this is. And I signed up for a team through a message board, and I hopped on this team, and it was a bunch of, you know, kind of legendary, like kind of trail run people in their community. And they let me on their team. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like I feel super cool. And they kind of took me under their wing and were like, just kind of telling me about how beautiful the sport is, what they get out of it, how it's made their lives better. And like hearing their war stories, I was like, this is crazy. Like this is, well, they're drinking from streams. Like, I mean, I was kind of a city kid in a way, a suburban kid, and they're drinking from streams and they're jumping over snakes. I was like, this is wild. And then reading McDonald's afterwards and drinking beer. Like this is insane. So I got kind of a really like school of hard knocks, grassroots introduction into it. And all this time, like I'm running this Ragnar Road relay. I don't have a GPS watch. I'm wearing like a pair of ASICS trainers. Like I don't even know that any of this world really exists, but I'm putting my time in, I guess, and I'm enjoying it. So
this was before the JFK, is that right? That you were in the Ragnar?
I used it as training for JFK.
Good plan. And luckily you got picked up by a bunch of trail runners on that team.
Yeah.
So right. Yeah, what if it was a
some triathletes?
Yeah, triathlete. You'd be in spandex right now.
Right. Well, I do remember our team being different. Like everyone just had like a different, like I know like our team, we had we were all wearing like fuel belts, which I guess it wasn't, I thought it was just what everyone wore, but no one did. There was like trucker hats and bigger sunglasses. It was just a different type of team, but maybe that's what, yeah. Hey,
I want to put a thing. I think that the one of the roads that you have to cross to become a trail runner is everybody has to have one of those fuel belts that has those little bottles that only hold like 4 ounces of water, and there's like 15 of them. You look like Batman.
Scott, when I don't mean to interrupt you, Michael, but I remember my first AR-50 back then, and I showed up with these, and there's six of them, and because I could hold six, and they have openings about the size of a nickel.
A pencil, yeah.
And so I've got all six in my hand, and I step up to this guy who's got a pitcher in his hand, and he looks at me like, are you kidding me? I've got ice cubes in here and fluid, and you want me to get it inside these bottles? And I really felt at that point, I need to up my game a little bit, that this fuel belt, although looked like a good idea in the catalog, because it spreads the weight evenly all the way around you, is not efficient at refueling. But these are lessons we learn along the way, right, Michael?
Well, it's funny because I went through like the gear phase, I think, as most do. And then I went to like the following Tony Kropitschka's blog, like riding the wind phase, where then I started. And eventually we can talk about how I got there. But I was living in Colorado and it's like, oh, just, you know, I don't need a bottle at all. I could just drink from streams or use this old plastic bottle that I squish and then refill with water. And yeah, it's just like, then I went to like the minimal, like nothing, like no shirt, just shorts and a small bottle. And yeah, hey. Shaving off my shoes and yeah. Mike,
there. Oh yeah, shaving the shoes. I know that video.
Hey, Mike, what is the biggest gear mistake purchase or acquisition that you have had thus far? That you thought this is going to be the coolest bit of piece of gear and you found out it was just junk. And you don't need to mention brand names if you don't want to.
No, actually, like, it's just kind of funny for that Ragnar road relay. We had to have like a reflective vest, and I thought, I was like, okay, this is a piece of gear that I need. And then at JFK, they give you a reflective vest at the very end. So this is all I know about like any type of ultra running and long distance running. So like I would eventually when I was moving around the country much, I was bringing this vest with me because I'm like, I need this vest, this reflective vest for races. Yeah. And it turns out like, no, it actually, you don't need that ever for anything, which is kind of funny because I always had this vest, but I don't know, like total mistake. I've had a lot of crappy headlamps. Like I've been, the lumen world has lured me in and I've been let down.
You know, Mike, the first headlamp that I ever had, and Don may remember this, and because he made a lot of fun of me, I thought more lumen the better. And like you say, lumens have come a long way. I remember this thing was like 120 lumen, and it was so cool because it had a wire that ran down from the headlamp to a hip belt that had C-size batteries in it, four C-size batteries. And I thought, this is the coolest thing in the whole world. And I show up, I think it was with Don the first time I got it. And I spent more money than I care to admit.
But there wasn't room for that belt and your fuel belt.
Anyway, that headlamp did finally make it to the rubbish bin.
The headlamps have come a long ways with the reflective lighting, the rechargeables, all of that stuff. And because I had a problem of not wanting, I always wanted to have a full charge, and I wasn't sure how much was left in this battery. And so I would, and not environmentally friendly, I would discard batteries before they were ready to be discarded because I didn't want to have a battery dying on me halfway through a run. But boy, with the rechargeables now, how nice is that?
Yeah, yeah. So you went and ran JFK 50. When did you finally get to the point where you said, this is not just a hobby, I want to make this my livelihood?
Wait,
am I too far ahead?
No, but I have a follow-up question on your 50 mile. At what point during that 50 mile run did you say never again, and how soon did you sign up for your next race?
So I never said that. The whole time I was absolutely loving it. I sound too positive here, but I'm a big Bruce Springsteen fan. I'm from New Jersey, so it's kind of in our, it's, you know, it's in like the pepperoni as a kid when you're eating pizza. But I wrote on my arm some Bruce Springsteen lines, like from one of my favorite songs, which is No Surrender. And it said like, no retreat, no surrender. And I kept looking at my arm the whole time. And the whole time I was just like, I love every bit of this.
Wow.
And it took me a while to sign up because I didn't know about races. I didn't know what was out there. So I just maybe I also wasn't good at the internet or something, but I just didn't know. I was like, oh, I think Western States is a thing, but that's in California. I'm in, you know, at this point I was like facing out of school in Virginia, moving to Philadelphia for a job. And I was like, I just love to run, but I don't know where these races are. So I was pretty naive to the whole scene, I guess you could say.
So what was your, before I get to your question, Scott, what was the next race? How long did it go? How did you find it? Because at this point, you know about Western States Run. How did you search? What did you find?
I think actually it was a year later, and I was living in Philadelphia, and the bunch of the crew from the Ragnar team, my longtime friend Michael Chow was like, "Hey, there's this new 50 miler. It's on the same day as JFK, but it's $20 and everyone gets in, and you want to come run it?" And it was the day before the Philly Marathon, and a bunch of friends, I was working in Center City for the North Face at a North Face store there. And they're like, "That'd be crazy if you could do both." And I was like, "Yeah, I could do both." And I did this like kind of like counter JFK 50 miler called the Stonemill 50, which is a really, really amazing race. It still goes on today. It's been eight or nine years since it started. Really, really cool race in Maryland. But so I did this Stonemill 50, and then I ran the Philly Marathon the next day. And then I was like, "Oh, I could run a 100 miler, you know, it's just kind of like this weird progression of like, let's just keep doing things and see where it goes. But no, I'm sorry. Actually, I'm wrong, because I signed up for that. And then in training, I did the stump jump 50K in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So I did that and got my ass kicked for any lack of a better word. I think I fell like 20 times and had 10 million stomach problems. And yeah, so I did that as a training run to do this other weird 50 mile marathon thing. So
I think that's one of the interesting lessons learned, is you can go out and you do your first one or you do your second one, and you start thinking, you know what, I'm pretty good at this. I can run that. And then you have the hiccup race that,
yeah.
And for me, it was also a 50K. And it kicked my butt. I of course, Don knows the story. I was the second to the last finisher at this race, and I didn't think I was going to finish. I thought they were going to have to bring a helicopter in to get me. And so you learn those things. You learn that you're human. You learn that anytime you start to get a little bit of self-esteem in trail running, you're going to get knocked down. You're going to be humbled once again, and realize that you're only one variable in this whole sport of trail running. Mother Nature and all sorts. There's so many variables.
Yeah, you know, the saying, respect the distance, always has to be there and ever present. And no matter how many times you've done it, there's always some question, how is it going to roll out? And if you mismanage, you know exactly how it's not going to happen. Not well. It's going to go bad. And no matter how many buckles you have or shirts you have, bibs you have rolled up in a big drawer, they can still humble you and hand you a lesson.
Sure.
Okay, can I ask my question now, Freeman?
Ready.
Okay. I want to know, at what point do you go from a loving this sport as a hobby to saying, I want to make this part of my livelihood?
Hey, Scott, it's time for a True Form Runner update, and we brought onto the line Dr. Mark Cucuzella, and as you know, he's the guy behind this whole fiasco, and so it's nice to have him held accountable here on this update.
It's actually his fault. If we go back to the origin of this, we had a discussion many months ago about, can someone train purely with a True Form runner? And since it's his fault, we decided he should come on and explain himself.
Yes. So Dr. Mark, why did you say that, yeah, I think a guy can run a marathon training exclusively on a True Form?
Well, I guess you guys are going to find out, right? So we have a hypothesis, right? You know, and then we test the hypothesis. And if our test doesn't confirm the hypothesis is wrong. So this is a beautiful thing.
Well, this could be a train wreck is what you're saying.
Yeah, seventh grade science or third grade science fair project, right? You make your hypothesis, you test your hypothesis.
Yeah, but here's the problem, Dr. Mark. I had complete confidence in you. I mean, if you said you could make it across the street, close your eyes, don't worry, there's a lot of traffic you hear, but you'll be fine, I would go completely.
You believe me, right?
I would.
Trust me, I'm a doctor.
100%.
So you just believe everything I say, you know? eat cholesterol and you'll never have a heart attack. It's all good. Eat 12 eggs a day. It's fine.
What made you think we could do this?
Well, I think you decided you wanted to do 100 miles. And the only bummer is I wish I could be there with you. You know, I have a high school camp that same week. I would have been like, I'm in, you know, because I think that adventure spirit is probably 90% of it at this stage. You know, all of us this year are just like looking for something interesting to do, you know, something you've never done that you probably will never do again. And as long as you show up that day without an injury and you have friends with you and you have some food along the way and, you know, you're somewhat trained and experienced in mountain running and you're fit, I think you'll get to the end of the line, you know, unless there's some weather condition or something out of your control. What I like about the TrueForm, Don, compared to like a regular treadmill, so we'll make the hypothesis here, you know, so, you know, in an ultra, there's a lot of variability in your movement pattern, right? Like, you know, shorter stride, longer stride. So with the TrueForm, you know, if you just hop on it, just say from now for the next 3 weeks, you're going to hop on it. You have an hour a day, you know, maybe one weekend day, you put in 3 hours because you got longer time, you know, just mix it up, you know, do some easy stuff, do some quicker stuff, do some strides, just mix up the variability with it. Like if you're on a motor treadmill, it would just drive you crazy. You'd have to start playing with buttons and you couldn't just go by feel. But that's what I have a TrueForm in my basement. And, you know, you just kind of just go by variability and mix it up. And your muscles like that, you know, and there's actually a physiologic benefit from doing accelerations and decelerations.
You know, I never thought of that. I mean, I've been thinking this TrueForm runner is a solution to improve your efficiency in your running gait, but I never thought about that it can enhance that variability that we see out on the trails. It's not like you're on a motorized treadmill that you set at like 9 and you got to keep that, even though your heart's going, you know, this is a little bit too fast. And then you have to push the button that slows down. I mean, you can actually change just like you do on a trail. I never thought of that. Thanks for bringing that up.
It's easy to overtrain on a regular treadmill. Like if you put it at like 9% and you think you want to do 20 minutes and you just trash yourself, you know, you've probably done no benefit to yourself.
You're absolutely right. You know, Dr. Mark, you can have some variability. I've taken 30 seconds and just kind of slowed down and give myself a little break and then re-engage back to my normal pace, just like you can on the trail. So to your point, Scott, there is total flexibility. One of the things I think that we dislike about treadmills is the motor. It makes us do exactly what it wants us to do. But with this TrueForm, without a motor on it, just a belt, we're making our own pace, just like when you're on the trail.
And you know,
I agree.
I'll throw something in there, Don. You've told me just the other day, I think you texted me and you said, I just did a 2-hour run.
2 hours on it. Wow. That's awesome.
100 degree heat outside, because he has it outside. 100 degree heat, 2-hour run. And you kept your heart rate like 120. And so you could keep that, monitor your heart rate and vary your speed depending on how you're feeling, right?
Just like you do on the trail.
Yeah, one thing, Don, I think the TrueForm will be really, you know, if you've had a month with it, you know, because you're 3 weeks out, you know, I haven't done a 100-miler, but I've done a lot of longer runs, ultras and trails. So I think your quad damage, especially with the descents, you know, you guys agree or disagree, but that's probably the limiting reagent, not like how much glucose or food you have in your pack or water, but it's how much damage your quads have taken before they just say uncle. But you know, so you really learn how to use the posterior chain, and I think neurologically you're gonna feel that and like, okay, my quads are a little tired. You'll be able to make that switch to just change your gait a little bit, whether you're on just a flat section, because you can be using your glutes and posterior chain, even going down the hill more. But certainly on the climbs, you're going to be tuned in now. You won't need to tap into your quads at all on all the uphills, because you've learned to use your glutes and just feel what it's like to run with them. And just try to reproduce that on the climbs and the flats, you know, and save your quads a bit for the downs.
There you have it, Dr. Mark. There's a true advantage, I think, that I'm learning, that you can get the mileage and the work, more work with less time. less damage to the body and less risk of injury.
Hey, Dr. Mark, this is great information. In fact, so much information. We're going to continue this on next week's podcast update of the True Form Runner Challenge.
Now let's get back to the show.
Okay, can I ask my question now, Freeman?
Ready.
Okay. I want to know, at what point do you go from a loving this sport as a hobby to saying, I want to make this part of my livelihood?
Yeah, so living in Philadelphia, I was working for the North Face, and Philadelphia actually has an amazing trail network just outside the city, and someone told me about it. And that was like the first time I really ran on trails. And at the same time, I met one of the best men in my wedding, my buddy Ryan, and he had a lot of connections to Vermont. He's like, hey, you want to go up to Vermont and run on trails? And I was like, oh, this is cool. And we started to like kind of sleep in our car and drive up to Vermont to run on trails on the weekends. And around this time, I'm also reading, you know, the Tony blogs, watching Solomon TV, you know, following Killian. And then we decided one day, we're like, let's just quit our jobs and move to Colorado. Like, I just want to run up mountains every day.
Yeah.
And this has been 2012. I had been training and I finished my first 100-miler, and we decided like, yeah, we're going to quit our jobs. And it was a group of friends of ours, and we met at a train station in Philly and took a train to Denver. And kind of like wandered around the American West, hiking, hitchhiking. We rented a car at one point, and just like all this time, I'm like trying to run as much as possible, like everywhere, anywhere. Had like a small little pair of like Brooks Pure Grit or something that came out, and I was just trying to like, yeah, just sneak out any chance I could to run. And we ended up actually like coming back to Frisco, Colorado, which is Summit County, after some time spent in Leadville, and we signed a lease. And dropped our stuff in the garage and flew home and then drove back out. And we were living in Colorado. So it was like pretty quick. Quit our jobs, moved west. And And then I started to take trail running more seriously. I had like mini projects in the mountains, and I wanted to run up this mountain every day. And I started doing better and better in races. And it just became like all I really wanted to do all day is run in the mountains. So
I have a little observation. I love that story, but I have an observation that is starting to become thematic in your story. One is you mail in your entry fee to JFK, yep, and you took a train to Colorado. Well, pretty low tech guy, huh? There, Mike.
I was probably like on a Kerouac binge at the time, so I was like, if I'm going to Denver, I have to be on a train. And my buddy Ryan was definitely I guess sharing some beatnik conversations at the time. So, I mean, we also probably decided after like a dozen beers or something. And, but it was cool that it was like that. It was, the whole time, you know, I didn't have a smartphone, and I remember like rushing to like when we were backpacking around, which is maybe a nice word for saying like hitchhiking and being drifters. I remember like getting to public libraries to like check, like, did the new Solomon TV come out? Or what did Tony post in his blog? Like, will I see him up on this peak today? And which is kind of surreal, because like just a few years ago at a Solomon event in Boulder, I'm like having dinner with Tony and Joe and Francois and all this. It's just like, it's just crazy. Or to be on like a FaceTime call with Killian to talk about a product. It's just, it's pretty crazy now, but yeah, it's pretty wild.
That, you know, we all need friends like Mike Ambrose, because, you know, if you've got an idea, he's going to be yes. You just
there's no thought.
No, you just have to pitch it to him, and you need to do it at the beginning of the day, because you know you're going to leave in the next hour. So you don't want to tell him at night. Like that old Life cereal commercial, you know, Mikey likes anything or everything. It makes me think about that when it comes to pitching an idea to you. You're ready to roll.
Yeah, I guess I've said yes to a lot of opportunities, but you know, I'm super lucky that I've had opportunities to say yes to. So I'm very, very fortunate that I could get on a train and move to Colorado and decide to be a trail runner. And it's brought me to Annecy and Chamonix, France. Like I don't know how to really explain it. Just I'm very, very grateful for it. Definitely blessed.
What did you do for North Face when you were in Philadelphia?
I was just working in a real retail store. So it was kind of right after college, and I knew I was interested in the outdoor industry at this point. So I was just kind of managing a retail store, which was really cool, because I really got to see how a company like North Face operated. I mean, it's a really cool company, and they do a lot of, at the time, they're doing a lot of great stuff with the retail stores. I'm guessing they still do. And it was, just a really great company. I learned a lot. So it was a good, good intro.
So you quit that great intro job. You move out to Colorado without a job, become a traveler. I'm going to say, I'm not going to say a vagabond, but a traveler,
a dirtbag maybe. Would that fit? Cause that's a positive term in our community.
Yeah.
I mean, that's to be labeled a dirtbag is kind of an honor.
Yeah. And you signed a lease, there in Frisco. You need to pay for that lease somehow. What did you do for money? Where did you finally land?
It's funny. I had some history in working in restaurants. So I went immediately to the restaurant industry, but it didn't really work out. So I went actually worked for a Columbia store in Breckenridge. Hmm. So I did that for about a year and then moved to Leadville. And then when I moved to Leadville, I worked in a coffee shop for a while. Before coming back to Breckenridge to work at Vertical Runner in Breckenridge, which is no longer there, unfortunately. But so I got kind of like got the true run specialty experience there as a buyer and manager. So bounced around quite a bit.
Oh, let's just say you're building your resume because I see all of these things leading to your eventual position in Leadville. When you're working at the coffee shop, how many runners did you meet and tell them telling you about trails? I imagine that was just some magic happened there.
Yeah, it was pretty surreal. I mean, it was crazy too, because I mean, 1 year after, I made this pilgrimage to trail running, I was in a coffee shop and seeing like Scott Jurek and seeing Chrissy Mayle, who was the first person that inspired me, right? Like that was the first video I saw. And the barista, one of my best friends, my buddy Gavin McKenzie, was like good friends with her. And I was like, this is crazy. And being around that, but not just them, like being around the community, reading the stories about Leadville and then living it, this is really supportive, encouraging, beautiful energy. Like if you want to feel good about life, like walk into the coffee shop in Leadville on a busy Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon and hear about what people have done that day and have a coffee or even in the morning before people go out. It's just like, it's really inspiring for sure.
Hey, Mike, I want you to compare and contrast. You said that before you were a trail runner, you did a lot of surfing in college. That's a community that for me, I've taken one surf lesson and love it. But as I stand back, I don't know why I don't do it more. It seems like a very similar community, a very nature focused.
It's a soul sport. That's what we talked with Buzz about.
Burrell.
Yeah, Buzz Burrell. It's one of the soul sports.
Tell us a little bit about how surfing and trail running compare and contrast.
Yeah, I think there's just a general stoke, to get out and be in the water and to experience that force and that, just kind of sitting in the sun and sitting in the water, and it's kind of a very earthy experience. I mean, I think I feel the same thing when I'm on a ridgeline or in a mountain or on the trail. Obviously when you're done, it's like an elated feeling of accomplishment and just well-being. It's just a really good feeling. And you're eating burritos afterwards, which is cool too. But I think for me, it's what's really similar, like the sacrifices you would make in your day to do it. Like, I'd get up early or, leave work, on a break to go surf, or get up early to surf, or, you take a trip to surf. And that's a lot like in trail running where you kind of make sacrifices to do it. But I guess what's different is the median is different. The heart rate, the intensity is different. Running's a little bit harder on your body, I would say, especially in ultras where surfing is a little more therapeutic, I think. But I think that the common thing is probably just the joy you get from it and the sacrifices you make to experience it.
How about the community, the people that you're floating next to in the water versus passing on the trail?
Yeah, I think you have to love it, right? And I think that's what's cool is that you're around people who just generally love it. They just love being there. They're grateful to be there. It's really supportive. It's encouraging. Everyone's kind of looking out for each other. It's generally uplifting. I mean, obviously you get a person here and there that isn't really, but they don't last long, right? They don't really last long, or at least not in your community, or they're not really around you very long. So it's a really positive, encouraging. Like you said, it's a soul sport. So it's going to breed that. So
That's good to know, because I probably stayed around away from surfing for this long because I watched Point Break. And I realized that those,
I guess it all depends.
A lot of the real surfers, you know, don't look kindly on newbies, and so that maybe that's the reason I've stayed away. But it sounds like surfers are also as warming and welcoming as trail runners are.
At least that was my experience. And if we were to go surfing together, I'd be super stoked to do it. So. I can only speak highly of that community. So.
And some mentoring, I would imagine, if I'm just hearing this, that they're supportive and welcoming. There's a lot of mentoring that goes on and teaching, and people aren't afraid to share.
Definitely.
I was going to say, I have a friend that quit his job and moved out to Southern California to become a surfer, and on purpose he had enough money in the bank that he didn't have to find a job. And he says, I want to be a surfer. And so he went and bought a surfboard. He went out to the beach, and he was from Idaho, or is from Idaho. And so he's out there with the wax, and he's waxing the bottom of the board. Mm-hmm. And an old guy comes by and said, dude, and he goes, what? He goes, let me teach you a few things. And he says, the wax mm-hmm. goes on the top of the board. And then right. he said, the most amazing thing happened before they even got in the water. He and this older guy sat on the beach and just watched waves. And he taught him how to read waves and the sets as they came in. And he said, it was so amazing to have this guy just take me under his wing and teach me about surfing. And that's why surfing really kind of catches my eye, if you will.
That's cool. Yeah, it's definitely a really strong community. And I learned a lot from my immediate friends. Yeah, some really close friends that I looked up to and learning, because I didn't grow up necessarily doing it. It's something I also learned later in life. So yeah, you rely on your community, you rely on your friends. And I did the same thing in trail running. So yeah, it's cool. It's really cool.
And when there's a little bit of risk involved and safety is in question, I think that's where communities really bond, the larger the risk, whether it's rock climbing, mountain climbing, you know, cycling, you know, mountain biking, running, or what we're talking about, surfing. There's risk. Mother Nature can take you out anytime she wants. And so we have to unite and share experience and teach one another to keep safe. Otherwise, we got to go back after the person, right? So we might as well teach them so we don't have to go after them.
Hey, tell me what is the difference between running back east, you know, in the places that you lived back east versus the Rocky Mountains?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference, you know, the East Coast was, I think there's a lot of ultra running history there. And it's a lot of, it's a really, really proud heritage too. I mean, as it should be. And the trails are different. They're, you know, definitely in New England, I think they're a little bit more technical than other places. Same in parts of Virginia as well. The scene is a little less of a scene, I guess. Like, it's a kind of like everyone, it's very silent. Like, everyone knows who the legends are, but everyone kind of walks a little more silently through it. Out west, it's a little bit more of a production, nothing compared to this like here in France or in Spain or Italy, but it's a little bit more of a scene, you know, obviously Boulder being such a hotspot at the time. And I think Seattle was at one point, and Flagstaff and San Francisco. I think there's just a little bit more of a visual presence. And a lot of the trail running we know today in the US is more seen through that Western lens, where the heritage is definitely, you know, it's on the West and East Coast, but we only really saw a lot, you know, we only really saw most of the West Coast stuff, you know, that really came alive with social media. So it's just a little less of a scene, I think, out east, and as opposed to out west, where it's a little bit more fanfare, a little more celebrated. You know, that's where a lot of the bigger races are now, or at least the ones with prestige. But, you know, I mean, you can't tell me that the Hellgate 100K or, you know, Massanoon or some of these, you know, iconic races in the East aren't tough or are cool or legendary. I mean, they certainly are. Then, yeah, I mean, the West Coast scene in the U.S. is significantly different than, you know, a little village race here in France. But, yeah, it's just a little different.
So now take us over to Europe. Now that you've kind of, we're familiar with the U.S., either the East, the Rockies, or the West Coast. All of a sudden, you end up over in France and in the Alps. What was your first impression?
Oh man. So I'd only seen it on, you know, Solomon TV episodes and, you know, it just looks insane. Like, you know, you see some of these races and you're just like, this is unreal. This is like, I mean, this is like the most popular, biggest spectator trail race in the US times 100. And then you get to Chamonix, for example, and it's even bigger than that. Like you can't really comprehend it. The way they treat it, it's such a well-defined sport in Europe. Trail running, it's part of culture, especially in mountain towns. And it's a really cool recipe of like big mountains and, you know, because the Mont Blanc is 12,000 feet above the valley floor. So you're walking down Main Street and it's, you know, say it's the Mont Blanc Marathon weekend and there's all these runners and there's 3,000 runners or something and big mountains and there's all this energy and it's like, you feel like you're at the Super Bowl. I mean, I've never been to the Super Bowl, but like, I would think that that's how being in the Super Bowl would feel. And it's just crazy. Like people are coming to the valley just to watch. And then, you know, when you run a race, like there's people on ridgelines and lining the course just to watch. And that's just what they've been doing every year. And yeah, it's a different type of different animal. But it's really beautiful to see the celebration of the sport that they love so much. So the fanfare, it's just incredible.
You know, over here, trail running is such a niche little sport. I mean, you have to be in it to know of it. I mean, you didn't even know about it and you discovered it because you tripped over it. But over there in France, everyone knows about it. I mean, it's ever omnipresent. I mean, there are the stores are celebrating, flags are all over the place. You can't not know about it. That's got to be just an amazing just experience.
It's cool as a trail runner to see, like, you know, walk into a store in Chamonix and like they have a trail running section. I mean, their trail running wall is five times bigger than a wall you'd find in a typical run specialty store. And it's every little gadget, you know, because all the races have required gear. So yeah. That's another element. Like, you know, you could start the Hard Rock 100 in your boxers if you wanted to and go run for, you know, however many hours it takes. But here, you know, you run a 20K trail race. You need to have space blanket, emergency blanket, you know, gloves, hat, buff, water. So like the equipment is such a big part of it. So you go into like a cool shop in Chamonix and you see equipment you didn't even know existed. And then you need to carry it all for this, like, you know, could be 2-hour, 3-hour race, which is definitely different.
It's almost like the race directors own stores.
That may be the case.
Just
right?
A theory. Just a theory.
Hey, Mike, just to juxtapose, what's your favorite piece of gear now? Now that you're living in an area where gear is such a big deal, what's your favorite piece of gear?
I mean, I definitely love footwear. I mean, that's part of how I've gotten to this role at Solomon, being the product line manager for trail running footwear. But, you know, there's actually right now, there's a new filter that Solomon makes for your soft flask. So it's amazing that I don't have to carry really any water with me. I can just carry a flask and have a filter. So to me, that's like, I hate carrying, like starting, you know, a run with like bouncing flasks and tons of, it's awesome that I can start a run with nothing and then fill it up, you know, along the way. So I really, really like this little filter. This little thing goes a long way.
So selfishly, are those on sale somewhere? Can we get one of those? Cause I would like to have one. Is it online? I'm interested.
I think so. I think you could probably get it. I'm not trying to plug Solomon here.
Yeah, no.
But I mean, I bought mine on Solomon.com in France, and I guess they're in the US, but it just screws onto a soft flask.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know how much it costs, like 10, 15 bucks or something, but it's amazing because you can drink from anywhere. And I get made fun of a lot here in France that, oh, you Americans don't like to drink from streams, but from someone who's, you know, been up all night because they drink from streams. Maybe that's why I'm attached to this little piece of gear too. But yeah, this little filter, I don't know. It's game changer.
Yep. I'm going to check that out.
How long have you been in Europe now?
About a year and a half, a little less, but just over a year.
Do you still wear shorts or are you into the spandex? Have they converted yet?
Best question of this episode.
Well, it is funny. I went running with a friend and I showed up one morning in spandex and he was like, oh, you're a Mike. Welcome. And I was just like, because I wore my first pair of spandex, but no, I'm still wearing shorts. And
is there an advantage to wearing spandex? I mean, there's a reason that they do it.
You know, the shorts that I have, I like, cause they have a lot of pockets around the waist. I think, you know, I mean, these are compression too. And I think compression works, you know, sometimes like depending on what you're doing, but I don't know. It's probably part of the look. Like you kind of look like you just came off a bike or just went for a Nordic ski. It's like all the same. It's all the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's a look.
Okay. Let's learn how you made it to Solomon because that's a dot I haven't connected yet.
Yeah, I was, I've always kind of been a Solomon fan, geek, nerd. But I thought the brand was super cool. You know, it's pretty funny. When I was first getting into trail racing, I think it was at the Rock Creek race, I showed up and Solomon had a tent there and I'd never heard of Solomon before. And this is like 2011 and I never heard of the brand. And I met this guy, I've been name dropping a lot, this guy, Josh Korn. And he gave me a pair of speed cross and I was like, holy crap, these are wild. Like, what is this bright yellow neon shoe with these big lugs? And I wanted to borrow a pair for the race because like I don't know, I need to have this, I guess. And he didn't have my size, but he gave me a little DVD about Solomon, probably Killian's Quest thing, and I would watch it over and over again. And so I kind of just thought like, yeah, everything that Solomon was doing, I wanted to be a part of. And when I got to Colorado, you know, I was I was buying Solomon shoes to run in, and they were like they were my shoe choice for when I was getting into racing. And then when I worked for the running specialty store in Breckenridge, we were buying Solomon and we were selling Solomon, and I just created a really, really cool community around the brand. Like we were selling a lot of shoes and the reps were coming in, and I met the sales reps and the tech reps, and, you know, it's just like, I was just loving it. You know, and any chance that I could talk about Solomon, I did, especially with people who worked for them. And then a job opened up in New England, and I applied for it. And luckily a couple really nice Solomon people that I had worked with said really great things about me. And Solomon took a chance on me and moved me from Colorado to Boston. And I started working as a tech rep. But what's funny is that eventually I moved back to the West, to Ogden, where the US headquarters is. And I was working next to the guy, Josh Korn, who gave me my first pair of shoes ever at a race. And then just this past summer, we ran Transalpine together. And we've done Transalpine and a few stage races together ever since. But I remember looking up to him as just like this, you know, newbie into trail running. And then, you know, 4 years later, I'm in the office and he's having me over for barbecue or planning trail runs. And then we're running through the Alps, you know, every summer. You know, it's been 3 summers in a row we've been doing Transalpine. So, or 2 out of 3 summers, but yeah, it's just all pretty surreal in a lot of ways.
It is an amazing story. If I was reading this book, I would go, no, that these things can't all happen to this guy.
Yeah. So I moved out to New England to be a tech rep. And then I moved back to Ogden, Utah to start in the marketing department, at the headquarters. And then it's just evolved from there. So
what's a tech rep?
Yeah, that's wondering too.
It's the coolest job in the world. You drive around to stores, you talk products, you go to events, demo runs, community runs. You talk about the products, get people stoked. You go out for ice cream or beers after. It's the best job in the world. You're so connected in the community. You get to travel around and meet really cool people, and you learn a lot. Like it's like, if you want to get into the outdoor industry or into, you know, footwear, be a tech rep. It's like grad school. You know, you learn all the tricks of the trade and you meet cool people and you can really learn a lot about, you know, what you want to do in the industry too, whether it's sales, marketing. A lot of people become sales reps. I went the marketing route, but it's a really unique role, but I think it's the best job in the world.
Yeah. Are they hard jobs to get? Are there many out there or is it a select few? If somebody's listening to this and saying, yeah, I want to be a tech rep, how tough is it?
I would say, you know, when I went on to hire people, like, you know, having experience in a outdoor or running retail industry is really big because that's so much of the job. Or working for an event company. I was lucky that I also was kind of working for an event company on the side, helping out. So I had a lot of that, but I think just having, you know, working in a running specialty store, outdoor specialty store, working for an event company, even if you're a salesperson for another type of company, just and be really passionate. So like put your time in the roles, but I mean you can't fake passion. So be passionate, love it, and then, you know, brands will see that. But they are tough to get. I mean, there's not a lot of them. They come and go too. Right now, like the tech rep job, I don't think, unfortunately, with COVID is, I think a lot of those jobs were probably furloughed, which is really unfortunate. But yeah, it's a lot of it's just like eyes and ears, looking at job websites, meeting people, and putting your time in a shop. Yeah.
Yeah. And just being a good guy, being somebody or a gal, being somebody that somebody wants to be with and work with, and being positive.
Yeah. Just love it. I mean, just share the passion, and that's what it's all about. Like, that's what you're doing. You're just sharing the love for it.
So product line manager at Solomon, what does that mean? We learned about tech rep. Now let's learn about product line manager. What is that?
Yeah. So it's technically a marketing role. And basically what I'm doing is I'm working a couple of years in advance on future projects and products, and looking at what consumer needs are, what the market's doing, and briefing our design team and our development team, and there's a lot of teams that are working to produce shoes and trying to come up with the best equation that turns into a shoe and can come to life in the market and be a success. So a lot of time in the field, understanding consumers, looking at market feedbacks from around the world, and trying to be in the front of trends. But also, doing what you do already really well and evolving things. And it's not always about new things. It's about evolving prior products as well. So yeah, it's kind of like a lot of consumer insights, marketing, sales, commercial. And then how does that look in a shoe, and working with the designer to bring it to life? So
how do you recognize a trend? What kind of clues do you have that give you an indication where Solomon needs to go?
There's always data. I mean, now data is so readily available, of like race participation, run participation, gender, distances, who's doing what, where they're doing it. We can see, what percentage of consumers in Denver are buying, X brand. There's a lot of data that's available. But I mean, what I think what really goes a long way, and I've actually felt this a lot this past week in bringing a project to life in a couple of years that we're just starting to see samples of, it's just like a gut instinct. You just kind of know, from being around it and listening. And Doug makes fun of me that, like, we'll go out and eat in Chamonix, and I'm like staring at everyone's shoes. I'm like, like picking up on things. And it's just kind of like eyes and ears open to what's happening. And I think that gut, goes a really long way. And just knowing,
As you're spotting trends, do you look at US trends? Do you look at European trends? Do European trends set precedents for the US, or how do you differentiate between the two markets? Or maybe there's just one. I'm curious.
Yeah, I think now more than ever, there's more common needs, for sure. I mean, I think before, over the past few years, there's been very specific needs to even regions in Europe. Where Germany, Austria has different needs than Italy and Spain, and France is totally different. The UK and the Fells are different. What does the US need? But now we're starting to find some common grounds, which is really cool. It makes the job a little easier. But yeah, I'm looking at everything from things in my backyard, like here in NC, like running, or in Chamonix, like just seeing what people are wearing, and then taking trips back to the US and communicating with the US team as well on what they're seeing. So yeah, and athlete feedback. And that's also goes a long way. Being on the forefront of something that an athlete needs that we maybe haven't seen before. So
I've been really curious, and you're the guy to ask. You watch what Ultra has done, right? Zero drop, wide toe box, that whole thing. And it looks like Hoka is kind of following that wider toe box a bit. But I've seen that Solomon seems to be on their own path. They're not moving over or creating a model that is a duplicate. You're standing your ground. Do you have any observations or comments, or am I just not, my eyes aren't open enough? Maybe you've done it.
No, I mean, I think traditionally Solomon has been a little bit more precise in the fit. There's been models that are, the new Sense Ride 3 is definitely a little bit higher volume in the forefoot. Same with the Speed Cross, a little bit higher volume than it has been in the past. I really can't go too much into it, but there could be some change in the future around that. Solomon, we have this really rich mountain history and this really rich, you know, ultra distance and trail running history. And we've been doing it a certain way, and we know we have a lot of fans, and we know we want to continue to please our fans. And, but yeah, we're always looking at new ways to innovate and new things. So yeah, some models are a little bit wider than they have been in the past. That's for sure. I mean, it's a direction that the sport's going that people need, but yeah, we'll see what the future brings. I really can't touch on it too much, but, yeah.
I you go with what works, right? I think it was Chrissy Moll that we were talking to, and she says she wears, a 4 to 8 millimeter drop shoe because that's what she started in, and she's never been hurt in it. It works for her, yeah, she's staying in it.
She bought a whole bunch of them and put them underneath her bed, right? And she just keeps rotating them.
Yeah, she says that's just works, and so sometimes we get caught up in. And not to offend you at all, but the marketing hype of something when in reality, maybe that's all it is. Maybe it's not founded on any hard science.
So product line development, how much do you get from your athletes like Killian? How much does he weigh in? When I slip on that SenseRide shoe, am I putting on Killian's shoe?
Yeah. So if you, so we've been working with Killian now for, geez, over a decade, and, definitely, yeah, he was in the S-Lab Sense, the white and red shoe, the Killian shoe, that is the Killian shoe. That's, he was the athlete in charge of that and been really important in the development of it ever since. If you saw what he wore at Sierra's and all, you'll, where he broke the record this past summer, there's a new shoe. So there's a new shoe that's coming, the new Killian shoe, and that's definitely the Killian shoe. The Sense Ride, the Sense Pro, which are deviations of the S-Lab Sense, are all very, there's elements, which is really cool. Like the Sense Ride 3 as it is today, like there's elements of that shoe that are from the original S-Lab Sense that he wore to win Western States, that they developed, 364 days later to win Western States. And there's still elements that live on. So, and he's always on the forefront of new ideas and things. And it is cool that over the past few years, though, he's been running in, very much just shoes you can buy at range shoes. He hasn't been testing too much outside of what we saw at Sierra's and all. But yeah, so in a sense, yeah, you're slipping on the Killian shoe. There's a new one coming in due time, which is really, really exciting. It's going to be super cool.
I think you already answered this, but I in every podcast, I try to work it in that I used to ski.
Scott used to snow ski.
And I'm familiar with Salomon because they were huge. They are huge in the snow sports. And, but the skis that you see, the pro skiers, the Olympic elite skiers, the only similarity of that ski and the one that you can go down to the ski shop and buy is the top sheet, the graphic. Everything right. Inside is completely different. And we, as when I used to ski, we were always trying to get our hands on a pair of race stock skis because they were so much better. You're telling me that the shoe that Killian wears, once it's fully developed, and he may be using prototypes or whatever, but once it's fully developed, it's the same shoe. You're not using some special EVA foam or top secret polymers in that shoe.
No. So, yeah, for example, like Zagama last year, he wore a Sense 7 soft ground. That's what he wore.
You could have bought it off the shelf.
Right. I mean, wow. Yeah. I mean, and if you see athletes with a prototype shoe, which Salomon does a lot of the reason you see that is us trying to be transparent and just saying it is something they're testing. They could be combinations of things. Most of the time, there are things that are available in the range. They were just maybe testing a combination or looking for a new idea. So, and especially now with the new prototype rules, we're definitely going to respect that coming from World Athletics around, what Kipchoge, the shoe around the Breaking 2 project. But yeah, I mean, what Killian wore at Zagama, like, I mean, I wore the same shoe and I was standing on the sideline.
Did you run as fast? Did you run as fast as he did?
If I could run one race, one Zagama as fast as Killian ever ran any Zagama, I mean, that would be a dream come true. As if I'm not already living the dreams.
Yeah.
Hey, well, just wait. Everything's happening well for you, Michael. Yeah. I think that might be in your cards. What are the new rules about prototypes without getting too into the subtext? What are the things that have changed? Yeah.
So the bigger rule, and I don't want to be held to this, to the exact quote, because I don't have it right in front of me, but the way I understood is that World Athletics stated that athletes have to be able, athletes have to run in a shoe that is available to the market at least 4 months before the event, which is part of the mad dash of brands trying to get these shoes out before the Olympics this year. So you saw like an overload of carbon shoes in the market. It's because they had to release them before the Olympics so that their athletes could wear them. So there's some trail races that are governed by World Athletics, some mountain running. I really can't speak on which ones are, but we are sensitive to that, and we'll be checking with different races to make sure that we're not in violation. So yeah, I think to summarize, it's like 4 months before the race, the shoe has to be available to everyone to purchase. You can't have things that are custom fit. You can modify shoes, but there's some fine print in there. I don't know, but I would encourage everyone listening to check it out. It's pretty interesting. And that also ultimately fed a really kind of a renaissance in road running shoes around carbon and what we're seeing. So yeah, if you're into shoes, I would check out the World Athletics policy on prototypes and shoes. Yeah.
I'm pretty familiar with at least with the carbon that's in some of the road shoes. And I'm embarrassed to say, has that crossed over into the trail?
I've heard of brands trying it. I don't know to what extent. You know, I saw a shoe that was on Instagram yesterday. It was a road shoe. I don't want to name brands or anything, but they put a trail outsole on it. I think it's definitely in everyone's minds. I don't know. I don't think it's in trail shoes yet, but I wouldn't be surprised in the next 6 to 8 months if something comes out where there's a carbon trail shoe for sure.
Oh, I'm wondering with the flexibility that a trail shoe needs to go over rocks and roots and stuff, maybe you lose some advantage on the pavement. It's like you can just rock along. But on the trail, you need to have a foot that folds to your terrain.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how that would. It would probably be a little unstable, I would think, at some level. It's probably awesome for going uphill. You know, if you're, it'd help give you a little spring. But it'd probably be a little squirrely, I think, because you wouldn't have the same stability on uneven surfaces. So
yeah,
it'd be firm. Yeah.
So how long does it take to go from prototype concept to shelf at your running store? Is that a 1 or 2 year process? I have no idea. I'm curious.
Yeah, it all depends on the brand. I mean, it could be really big brands that are super agile and have really fast production. It could be 6 months, 8 months. For slower brands, I think it could be 2 or 3 years. We're kind of, I'm already thinking a couple of years out all the time. So I'm living in the future, but it all depends. It depends on the process. It depends on the shoe. It depends on the brand and how they want to do it. So there's really not a set time. I would say like 2 years is probably industry standard, around 18 months to 2 years.
Do you get a chance, Michael, to get some of the first rides and be a shoe tester?
Well, so the worst part about my job is that I'm not sample size. So if I was sample size, I'd be like, that might actually be the dream.
Yeah.
Cause I'd be running and everything. But I'm a little bit bigger, but I've had a few pairs that have been made for me to test some various combinations of things or new materials. And that's always super cool. I mean, that's one of the coolest things for sure. You can't have a bad run when you're testing one of Solomon's, future products. So
you know, like when they have new cars and they mask it with all these different types of body armor, so you can't tell what the new Chevrolet Camaro is going to look like. Would they have to do that with your shoe because they recognize you and they go, that's the testing guy. And so they put some kind of funky look to that shoe so they couldn't get a firsthand view of it.
There's times where we hide them and we make them more hidden than for not necessarily for me or for an athlete, but if we test them with a consumer group or something, we'll try to be as anonymous as possible. But I think that's pretty normal.
I'm curious what test size is. Is it Killian's shoe size? Is that they just knew that he was so important to Solomon that they said, okay, he's now the test size? What's a test size?
It's a 9 US is a pretty standard sample size across almost every brand. So Killian's about a couple sizes smaller than that. So But I mean, we can always make a shoe for that, for a person's size, you know, depending on how they want to do it. But yeah, if you're a size nine, US nine, work at a running store, geez. I mean, work in a running, like a running brand. It's the golden ticket. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Hey, Mike, I'm always striving to look better than I actually run. I'm curious, in your role, is there research and time the designers put into color? Is color important, and does it shift from season to season? And because I want to know what this next season, the COVID, post-COVID season, what color I need to be in.
I've got to get a shirt that matches my shoes, Michael.
Yeah, it's color. We have a color team at Salomon for sure.
A color team. Ah, nice.
Team's looking at color, and I think most brands do. And if you see similarities in colors, like if you're walking around the running event and you're like, oh, Saucony, Brooks,
yeah,
Salomon, Mocha, it's because there's very similar, you know, in vogue and on trend colors. So, I mean, Salomon, it's cool. I mean, there's always the racing red and you know, the white, yeah, and red's pretty standard, the black and red and the blue and all that is pretty standard. But yeah, we're always, evolving with colors, and you'll probably notice like apparel kind of will match that, and there'll be hints and stuff. So yeah, you can always match.
I never want to clash. That's my, when I leave the door for my training run, top of my mind is clashing.
I think maybe you can speak to this, Michael. I think maybe over in Europe, there's a bit more coordination. It seems like not being coordinated here is more hip.
Right. Right. Is that, yeah, true? It's funny. Like, head to toe, there's like my first time running in Chamonix, I was like standing in the starting crowd and I was like, does that dude run for Salomon? Does that guy run for Hoka? Because everyone's head to toe kitted out.
Yeah.
But in the US, you just don't see that in the same way. Like if you see someone head to toe in a kit, you're like, oh, that's, you know, that's sponsored. But here it's just, I go for a run in the morning and there's people head to toe Salomon gear. I mean, it's part of where I live, you know, at the headquarters here, but yeah, you just don't see that back in the US as much.
Yeah, we've got guys in flannel shirts and straw hats and all kinds of stuff.
Okay. Hey, I have one final question for you. You've been over in Europe now for a little over a year. What's your favorite thing about living in Europe?
Man, favorite thing that's unique to Europe, because I mean, I would say, you know, the access to the mountains, but yeah, that's, I mean, you can get that a lot in the US too. You know, I would actually say that, you know, that where I am specifically, like the types of mountains, like the relief on the mountain, it's just crazy. You know, you can be in Chamonix, for example, and these mountains are, you know, 4,000 meters above you, 12,000 feet above you. Like it's just so big. It's so vast. And it's hard not to be inspired. It's hard not to just want to get out and move in the mountains and, you know, around every turn. I mean, I guess this is similar to like when I lived in Leadville a lot of ways, but, just how big and how technical the mountains are out here and how you can climb for 2 hours out of a valley and just like still have 6,000 feet to the, wow, you know, mountains above you. It's just so big. It's just one big, big world of inspiration. But I mean, I guess that's anywhere. So I don't know. I'm just really inspired every day. And I don't know if that would follow me everywhere, but I know I feel really, really inspired here in Europe.
Are you still translating to metric or are you thinking in metric?
I'm probably thinking in metric now. Yeah. I'm in meters and Celsius and grams, definitely grams, because at work, everything's grams.
Yeah.
I guess the final cap on that question, tell me what your watch is set in, meters, kilometers, feet, or miles? Because that's the real answer. Min meters?
Meters and kilometers, yeah.
Okay, well,
there you go.
There's the answer. Hey, Michael, it's been fun talking about your passion for trail running, yeah, how you got into it, and how you went from 0 to 100 to living the dream. And it's really cool. And I'm sure that all of us put ourselves in your shoes and thought, man, that dude, he got it done.
So, and they were Salomon shoes that we put ourselves in.
Well, of course, naturally.
Yeah, thank you guys too. I mean, I listen to your podcast. It's always fun to hear some American trail running talk too, especially over here. So thanks for all that you guys do. Yeah, it's super cool. And I feel grateful to be talking to you guys.
Well, we hope here in the post-COVID near future, We hope to get out to the Alps because Doug invited us. He said he had a couple open spots on his floor that we could roll a sleeping bag out on, and maybe we'll get to enjoy some of those big mountains.
We'll get to meet you.
Yeah, and if you guys want, there's a new virtual tour that Doug's doing through Run the Alps of Chamonix, which is, it's pretty cool. Like, you can virtually experience all the trails in Chamonix. So if you ever wanted to come over here, like, it's pretty cool little intro to know where you could actually come run. So if you want to experience it, he's running a virtual tour in conjunction with his Run the Alps. So it's super cool, really interactive, and yeah.
And if you're interested, that's runthealps.com that you can find that. Are you working for Doug as a team member, as a guide?
No, I'm an ambassador, so I have some ambassador duties, you know, with Run the Alps, and just kind of a sounding board. We just kind of collaborate on some ideas and talk. My wife's working for him, so I'm kind of on the sidelines, but I get to help out and kind of help. Help with some content stuff here and there as an ambassador. So yeah, it's super fun.
Cool.
Well, that sounds good. Thanks for sharing all that with us. And we encourage you to go to Run the Alps and do a virtual run. I'm going to check it out. I have not checked that out, and I look forward to, and until we get over there, Michael, it's great to meet you virtually, and we will make a plan to get out there.
Cool. So, yeah. I'll be listening to you guys. See ya. Thanks.
Yeah. So don't forget to go and run.
Mas.